Nigh under 4 years, the armed forces of the United States and their allies fought the Japanese all over the Pacific. The Japs drove them out of Wake, Guam, and the Philippines. They cleared the British out of Hong Kong, Malaya, and Burma, the Dutch out of Indonesia. They knocked at Port Moresby, the gateway to Australia. Then on April 18, 1942, Jimmy Doolittle and his boys bombed Tokyo. In June, the American fleet went to work on the Japanese Navy off Midway. The Marines invaded Guadalcanal and Tulagi. A United States force moved into the Aleutians. Came victory in the Battle of the Bismarck Sea and in New Guinea, in Tarawa and Macon, the Marshalls, the Admiralties, New Britain, the Carolines, and the Paleus. Island hopping was the strategy. The swell increased to a tidal wave. The road to victory led from every direction. Among the dozens of little sideshows in all of this were such incidents as those involving Tokyo Rose. Major Steve McCormick, who landed on Saipan with the Army, recounts his reactions.
That Tokyo Rose was quite a gal, all right. Her propaganda was the insidious type, but it boomeranged, made the boys mad or laugh on occasions at some of her nonsense. I'll tell you, as an example, we'd been getting along for weeks on K-rations and warm, chlorinated water when she came on the air one day with a description of a home-cooked meal back here in the States. She talked of steaks, French fries, corn on the cob, hot rolls. Boy, at first, your mouth would water, and then you'd get burned up at that gal. Remarks would be made like, "We'll be in Tokyo soon, Rosie. Take care of you then." Or, "Go whistle up your kimono sleeve, chum." And, well, there were other, more pointed comments, too. I'd better not repeat them here.
Tokyo Rose was a stooge of Japanese psychological warfare. Actually, there were 7 such girls, but today, 2 years after VJ Day, Eva Toguri, the California-born and educated Nisei, is still around Tokyo, living in a hovel outside the capital, seeking only to be forgotten as the Japanese want to forget. 10 days ago, she had this to say to Burton Crane, mutual correspondent.
I'm one of those persons who hope that we can forget the past, and I have a lot of it to forget and concentrate on the future. Can't we let bygones be bygones?
We're making an historical record, and it wouldn't be complete without the voice of Tokyo Rose.
Sometimes I think that most history should be forgotten.
I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you've done. I'll bet you're sorry that you went to work for that old rising sun. You stuck a knife into the USA. You forgot what they learned you at UCLA. I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you... Sorry for what you've done.
The 1st Marine Division was looking forward to a date with a certain gal in Tokyo, Tokyo Rose, whose Mae West voice had propagandized for Japan over the shortwave radio. The boys decided to send their gal friend a letter, and here they are sending their love note.
Dear Tokyo Rose, because for so many, many months now you've entertained the Marine Corps in general and the 1st Division in particular, we feel that the only gentlemanly thing to do is return the compliment. So we have a little number we're going to play tonight, dedicated just to you. But first, Rosie. In regard to those cracks you've been making, that the folks back home will forget about us out here in the Pacific when Germany surrenders. Rosie, I'm surprised at you. You know, ordinarily, you're a pretty smart propagandist, but this time you've certainly missed the boat. Why? Well, it's this way. You Japs, with your bowing and scraping to the man of the house, have about as much family life as a... as well as these jeeps parked out here in our motor pool. On the other hand, we and our mothers and sisters and dads and brothers have not only a devotion and a love, but we also have a mutual respect, and that's something you Japs couldn't possibly understand. Ah, Rosie, they haven't forgotten us out here, nor will they, and we haven't forgotten them. And now, as I say, just for you, we play Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee-29. Thank you. That's it, Rose. Good night and pleasant dreams. Signed, the
first. 1943. The war in the Pacific is moving toward Japan. Guadalcanal, Tarawa, names in the world atlas before, now household words. Only the strongest memories remain. Memories of battle and boredom and rare moments of relief, like a softly feminine voice from Radio Tokyo.
Hello, you fighting orphans of the Pacific. How's Chick? This is after her weekend, Annie, back on the air strictly under UNO. Reception okay? Well, it better be, because this is all request night. And I've got a pretty nice program for my favorite little family, the wandering bullheads of the Pacific Islands. The first request is made by none other than the boss. And guess what? He wants Bonnie Baker and my resistance as well. Now, what taste you have, sir, she said.
That somewhat garbled program provided the Allied troops with a feminine voice and popular music. Orphan Anne on the Zero Hour, playing music for her wandering orphans in the Pacific. But she and other women broadcasters for Japan were known to the GIs as Tokyo Rose.
Well, thank you. That's all for now, enemies, but there'll be more of the same tomorrow night. Until then, this is Orphan Anne, your number one enemy, reminding you GIs always to be good. Goodbye now.
In reality, there never was a program or person named Tokyo Rose. There were women broadcasters, nearly 20 of them, who played music and talked to the troops in the Pacific, and most probably broadcast propaganda. Tokyo Rose was the GI name for all of these female voices on Radio Tokyo. But when the war ended, history would have a single Tokyo Rose. She would become the first woman convicted of treason in the United States, but for 20 years would continue to profess innocence, living a silent life, branded a traitor, but feeling like a patriot. This is her story. How many people would rewrite their lives if at age 24 they had the knowledge of what would happen in the next 29 years? Iva Dakino would. She would change her life beginning with a trip to Japan, because it marked the beginning of a series of circumstances which would tear her life apart.
Well, I had gone over there to visit a sick aunt, my mother's only living sister. And my mother couldn't go because she was ill herself. She asked me to go and to see how her sister was, plus take her something that she needed, because they were very short of material things, because Japan had been at war with China for so long. So this is what I did. I went over there to visit the aunt.
She was caught between two countries at war. This is the story of a woman who maintained American citizenship while broadcasting for the Japanese, who denies the label Tokyo Rose and denies ever having broadcast propaganda, but who was convicted of treason. Iva Dakino was born in California, 1916, on the 4th of July. Her father was a citizen of British Columbia, her mother of Japanese descent. Medical research was her main interest, and she graduated from UCLA with a degree in zoology. It was in July of 1941 that, according to Japanese custom, she became the family representative at the expected death of an aunt in Japan. Japan's relations with the United States were frayed that summer, and Iva sought passage back home. But when she applied to the State Department for a passport to return to the United States, it was denied. The State Department sent word saying her citizenship had not been proven. It was an obvious mistake, since her later trial for treason was based on her U.S. citizenship. But fateful, it came 1 month before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The Japanese, however, considered her a citizen of the United States and she was immediately under the surveillance of an internal security force, in Japanese, Kempi Tai. Her aunt, having recovered, feared retaliation for harboring an American citizen, and Mrs. Dequino was turned out on the street to hunt for new quarters and a job. She took small ones until the fall of 1943, when there was an opening in Radio Tokyo for a typist.
The war started. There was very little work that I could do, since I did not know the Japanese language, and all I knew was typing in English. So I got a job as a typist at Radio Tokyo. And after I'd been there for some time, the head of the department asked me, we have an order from the exact translation would be General Army Headquarters, I guess, saying that you were to participate in a broadcast with the Allied prisoners of war who are being not used, but they are running a program here at Radio Tokyo, and you have been ordered to broadcast with the Allied prisoners of war, and this is how it started. I had never seen a mic before, but the head of the department said that the Allied prisoners of war had selected me, and they wanted me to work with them to put on this particular program.
You were an enemy alien at the time.
That's right, I was.
What were some of the scripts that you read?
Well, the scripts actually, they were like just introductions to music and giving some information on the content of the music, plus sort of asking the listeners to join in a sing-song thing, and sort of a get-together program type of script. But the Allied prisoners of war wrote all the scripts. They were, of course, pros at it, and they were able to prepare the scripts in such a way that it was entertaining and humorous without any of this so-called material which is attributed, you know, to this particular broadcast. A very free, easygoing, fun type of program.
She participated in 340 of those zero-hour broadcasts, and their value as propaganda is in question. Across the Pacific, if that value was measured by a decline in Allied morale, it was utter failure. Most GIs laughed at the programs. Many enjoyed them. Some said they could detect the weather conditions over Tokyo, useful if you were going to bomb it. In later testimony, Japanese authorities said that from their Tokyo headquarters, they decided the object of the Zero Hour was to cause the Allied troops to become homesick and disgusted with the war. One said it was entertainment only. Some Allied prisoners of war who participated in the programs testified they saw it as a chance to dilute the Japanese propaganda effort. They testified that they asked Iva to join their team. They could trust her.
Oh, I got along very well with the prisoners of war. It's a very strange feeling to see that there were Allied prisoners of war who were forced to broadcast, and they welcomed talking to someone from the United States, although the prisoners of war, there was one from the Philippines and one from Australia. They were all liked to talk about the States and the progress of the war. Some of the news I was able to get because through an agency where my later husband was working, we were able to get the intercepted Allied news, and I was able to take the news over to the prisoners of war.
What were you able to do for the Allied prisoners of war?
Well, not much, but I was able to supplement whatever, their diet with what little I could get them, whatever was available in vitamin pills and fruit, of which they ate seeds, skin, and all, because of the danger of pellagra. And they were short of, well, blankets and things. And I used to take the blankets to them, and they used to take them under their coats and take them into the prisoners of war camp after their broadcast. Many times there were some the prisoners who were having typhoid, I mean, not typhoid, but malaria attacks, and they couldn't get enough blankets. So I used to take in blankets, and they used to take them in for me.
There were some 20 women broadcasting for Radio Tokyo. What was the phrase? They all look alike? But did they all sound alike? This was Orphan Anne. The recording is an actual broadcast.
Greetings, everybody. This is your number one enemy, your favorite playmate, Orphan Anne of Radio Tokyo. The little sunbeam whose throat you like to cut. We're ready again for a vicious assault on your morale. 75 minutes of music and news for our friends, I mean our enemies in the South Pacific.
On the same zero-hour broadcast, this female voice was introduced as Dutchie.
Greetings and salutations to my dear friends in Saipan and all points north and south in the Pacific. This is Dutchie and Company with classic music for classic lounge.
This multiple voice broadcasting led to the description of Tokyo Rose as a composite of several women. When the war ended, although no one either in Japan or among the Allied forces really knew who she was, Tokyo Rose was as much a symbol of Japan as Tojo, or Slant Eyes. And Iva Dakino, the only American among the broadcasters who had not given up her U.S. citizenship, became Tokyo Rose.
Well, one of the fellows in charge, who incidentally was born and raised here, his wife had been as a substitute broadcaster on this so-called zero-hour broadcast. And when the Army or the CIC went to Radio Tokyo to search for someone to be associated with this image, he more or less directed them over to me to get them off of his back.
Japan was a defeated nation. Food was scarce, occupation government ruled, there was total confusion.
I was put in jail for over a year in Japan.
By U.S. authorities?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Under charges of treason there?
No specific charges. I was just dragged off and put in jail and just left there. You know, everybody forgot about me. I couldn't get any legal help or no counsel of any kind. And at the same time, I was questioned all the time, almost daily, by all different branches of the United States government, civil government, and the Army.
Were you released at all from jail?
Yes, after completion of over a year, they released me under orders from General MacArthur's headquarters. And I understood that General Willoughby's orders stated that there was no evidence whatsoever to connect me with this case, and so they released me.
Specifically, that government release order said the Department of Justice no longer desires Iva Dakino be retained in custody. October 6, 1946. Upon that release, she applied for a passport to the United States. Some say it was a radio broadcast in 1948 by Walter Winchell, prompted by a Gold Star mother that brought pressure upon the Justice Department to reopen the case. Others feel it was the work of two journalists, Harry Brundage and Clark Lee. They allegedly had interviewed Tokyo Rose and obtained information which they turned over to the Justice Department. Although none of the prisoners of war who wrote the programs had been prosecuted, one had even been promoted. In 1948, after a year in jail, Iva was arrested again, this time charged with 8 counts of treason. She was tried in San Francisco.
The trial? Well, it covered 13 weeks, and there's just a multitude of witnesses that appeared whom I've never seen before, I never heard of before, and yet they professed to have known me, they testified that they saw the broadcast, heard the broadcast, which was impossible because the Allied prisoners of war were under guard, and they couldn't have got into the studio. But they all testified that they heard me, say these things, and they saw me actually perform. So many of the witnesses were brought over here. I suppose it was right after the war, and the people, when they were asked to come, they were willing to come because they were given so much per diem and three meals a day and a trip to the United States. And a lot of people just jumped at it. Didn't make any difference what sort of witness they would make.
The indictment charged that her activities were intended to destroy the confidence of the members of the armed forces of the United States and their allies in the war effort, to undermine and lower American and allied military morale, and to impair the capacity of the United States to wage war against its enemies. Over 13 weeks, there were hours of testimony, much of it conflicting. The government presented 46 witnesses, the defense 44, 19 by deposition. The prosecution argued that she worked to create nostalgia and war weariness among the members of the armed forces to discourage them. The defense tried to show that she was part of a team working to water down the Japanese effort, that she broadcast under duress. The jury of six men and six women came back once from deliberation unable to reach agreement. The judge urged them to try again. After 5 days, they brought in a verdict. Innocent on 7 counts. Guilty on 1. That on a day during October 1944, she did speak into a microphone concerning the loss of ships.
And you went to jail for how many years?
About 6 years. Time off for good behavior.
And you still have a fine to pay?
Yes, I do. I still had that fine which was placed on me.
At any time did you feel that you were collaborating with the enemy? Or that your acts were treasonous?
No, I never felt that. I guess it's mainly because at the onset, when the Allied prisoners of war placed their whole program in front of me, and they said that they wanted me to become a member of their team and wanted to put on their type of program, and so that they could send these messages home. This is the only way they could send the messages home to their, you know, to the other parents, to let them know that they were living.
And that is not collaborating in your...
Well, no, I felt that I was working with them and helped them do what they tried to do in an enemy country for their own purpose.
You were, you are now, and you remained at that time an American citizen, didn't you?
Yes, I did. It was pretty rough at times because it was a very easy procedure to become a citizen of Japan. All you had to do was sign in an award. And that would have prevented all of this. If I had any feeling that it was going to hit me like it did, I would have just gone and signed in and become a citizen of Japan and not be liable.
Chicago, a long way from a broadcast studio in Japan or the war, a trial in prison. With time off for good behavior, Mrs. Dacchino came here in 1956. There is a small Japanese-American community, and she worked in a shop. She could seek anonymity among friends. Father was here. Her mother had died during the war in a relocation camp for Japanese Americans, Nisan, in Gila River, Arizona. Her work and family became her life. They had their own problems of relocation during the war, and the family knew nothing of what had happened to their daughter. Today, she feels it may have been hardest on them.
We're all rather stoic, so I think this characteristic is the thing that has sort of bound us together, and they've been very loyal. And I'm very proud of them. I really don't hold any bitterness. I don't think it's very healthy, number one, and I think you gain nothing from being bitter.
But lack of bitterness does not mean lack of feeling. And now she can relive it like some Monday morning quarterback.
Actually, looking back, when you analyze something like this, you feel that, if I had any fear of guilt after my initial release from the Army, you know, the Army was in control then, since I had been married to a Portuguese national, I could have been free from any charges by becoming a Portuguese citizen
And in fact, the Portuguese consul offered me free transportation to any position of Portugal. And he said, no, I'm not running away from anything. And I would kept my citizenship. So I believe that a leopard just doesn't change his spots.
So for Ivan Aquino, despite the years, it's hard to forget. But harder still to resist speculation about a slightly different set of circumstances. Would she be convicted today?
I don't know anything about law, you know, but with reading so many decisions handed down by the Supreme Court in the last, say, 5 years, it seems that the points of law that protects the individual has been, I don't know whether it's been clarified or laxed, or I don't know the correct terminology, but the reason why I mention this is I assumed all the time that anyone charged with a capital crime is certainly has a right to legal counsel, and which I never did have until I came back to San Francisco. I think there's a span of, 3 or 4 years after the cessation of war in 45. It was about 4 years subsequent to that that the trial actually began. So I have reason to believe there's a lot of opinions formed, you know, in that time. You have to sell newspapers, you have to sell magazines.
Ivan Aquino is in Chicago. She works in a small store. She has a circle of friends. She's quiet, and while she would like her side of the story told for a change, the thought of cameras and lights is frightening. She remembers the other times there were cameras and lights. Her attorneys are still fighting and urge her to speak out more. But as she says, they're in San Francisco, and that's easy to say. But life is comfortable. If that were all, there could be no complaint. But that's not all. The present is comfortable. It is the past that's troublesome. And for Mrs. D'Aquino, the past is the present and the future. Ivan D'Aquino will be remembered because the story of Tokyo Rose will not be forgotten. It is a memory of a generation caught in a world war. It is one of those comfortable pieces of history pigeonholed into its proper place. The case is closed for everyone except Ivan D'Aquino. The truth lies somewhere in the nagging dissimilarity between a legendary Oriental siren of the Pacific and a bookkeeper in Chicago 2 wars later.
Fear and belligerence? I know, you still hate us, but don't rest. been running Japan very long without a job, so I started looking for one. I found one of the Dome newsers, you see, entitled. Well, Dome didn't pay very much, so I had to look for another job, and I started around and found one at Radio Tokyo. Typed this again. Well, one day, city officials auditioned me quite unexpectedly for the lead on a special program beamed to you GIs in the Pacific, and they said that the purpose was solely entertainment. Well, I can truthfully say I enjoyed entertaining you GIs, and as far as the news announcements are concerned, I admit they're a little confusing at times, and I often wondered how many times the American fleet was going to be sunk before the show was over. That's all for now, enemies.